The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Ted Clout. For the appellant, Mr. Clout, is Mr. Timothy Wrench, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the State of South Dakota is Ms. Patricia Devaney, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Wrench, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This case is about what constitutes a rape. It is our position that in the state of South Dakota, there is no such thing as rape by trick. It's not like a larceny case where you can have larceny by trick. We are requesting that Ted Clout receive a new trial because he didn't have a fair one in the first place, in that his theory of defense instructions were not presented to the jury in such a fashion that we could argue them and base the defense based upon those instructions. Even with the result of that unfair trial, the evidence came in such a way that in the second issue, I'm going to be asking all of you to reverse three of his convictions because AM admitted so completely, so universally, and so totally that she consented to the acts that it never should have gone to the jury for decision in the first place. Understanding that we're here with students, by way of background, I'll talk about the facts somewhat. Ted Clout was a state legislator up out of Walker, South Dakota, married to Connie Clout. They performed foster home services for wards of the Department of Corrections, had numerous foster daughters come into the home, and the two foster daughters in issue actually lived with Ted Clout and his wife out in Walker, South Dakota. They were able to go into Walker, they were able to work there, they were able to go to school, and they lived with him for an extended period of time. When these charged events occurred from January of 2005 to January of 2006, the first alleged victim, A.M., was 17 years old when the first event began, and she was 18 years old when the last event occurred. The second victim, J.S., was 19 years old when the charged event occurred in Hughes County, and which was the subject of this case. In essence, what Ted Clout did is Ted Clout convinced these girls who were of legal age to consent, but they were foster children living in his home or had been living in his home. He convinced A.M. that if she were to take part in some procedures, some tests, she could qualify for egg donation and that she could make a lot of money doing this. And at the outset, A.M. was all for it. Yes, that's fine. I'd love to make the money. And they began upon a course of conduct where Ted Clout was examining her. And it was totally wrong what he was doing, but it's our contention that it was not rape. His examinations included measuring A.M.'s breasts, measuring her vagina, opening her vagina up with a speculum, inserting a dildo in the vagina to stimulate it under the guise of being able to withdraw fluid that would supposedly have eggs in it, and then going through this simulated fake procedure to withdraw fluid that would have eggs in it. All of this was so that AM could continue on in the egg donation procedure. And AM agrees. She agrees that from the outset, when these things would occur, she wanted them to occur. She was hoping that she could make money in the egg donation procedure, that she agreed to allow them to occur, that Ted Clout never forced her or threatened her, and that in essence she consented. Now, Clout did a lot of things he shouldn't have done, and one of the things that he shouldn't have done in this case was he had emails that were supposedly sent to him forwarded to AM under the guise of being some agent for an egg donation company and goading AM along, promising her money, things of that nature, communicating with her so that it would appear as though this was the real deal and she would continue to participate.
If a woman goes to a doctor for a pelvic exam and the doctor uses that opportunity to have sex with her, has she consented to sex?
No.
So what's the difference here then?
The difference here is Ted Clout said he wanted to perform these procedures upon AM, and AM said, go ahead.
She consented to this bogus procedure. She didn't consent to sex, and that's what he's been charged with, isn't it?
Yeah, but he didn't have sex with her. He didn't have sex with her. The question becomes, did he lie to her about what his act was? His act was putting the speculum in.
Well,
his act was putting
he's charged with sexual penetration, and the jury found him guilty of sexual penetration.
That's correct. And but so the very penetration that he was found guilty of, the very penetration that he's found guilty of, is precisely what A.M. said he could do and agreed to allow to occur. It's different than a doctor saying, okay, I need to have sex with you in order to perform this procedure.
Well, that's not the hypothetical I gave you. I would agree with you if a doctor convinced a woman that she needed to have sex with him for some health reason, that she's consented to sex, even if it's for a wrong reason. But if a woman goes to the doctor for a pelvic exam and consents to a pelvic exam, and then the doctor uses that opportunity to have sex with her, she's not consented to having sex, has she?
No, but the difference is, you said the doctor had sex with her. The woman consented to the pelvic exam. Let's say that she didn't need a pelvic exam, and the doctor said, you need a pelvic exam, and I want to perform one upon you, and she said, go ahead and perform the pelvic exam. The act in this case is the pelvic exam. It's not sexual intercourse.
Well, so it's your client's position that this wasn't sex, but that he was charged with having sexual penetration. His reason for doing these things to her were for sexual, prurient reasons. He had sexual penetration with her. The jury found that. You're disputing that was not, you're saying that's not sexual penetration when he was inserting these things in her?
No, I think that sexual penetration is defined as penetration, however slight, into the vaginal or other openings of a person, and that's what happened here.
So I guess I'm not following you then when you say this child consented to a procedure, much like a woman consents to a pelvic exam. And your client didn't give her a medical procedure. He conducted a sexual penetration on her. I don't think, is that in dispute, that he conducted a sexual penetration?
No, I don't think that's in dispute.
So,
I think
so
that
the
penetration that occurred is by its very nature sexual. He's not a doctor. He doesn't have any of that specialized training. There's no position that was a medical necessary procedure. But the difference is, under your hypothetical, if a doctor is conducting a pelvic exam and then has sex with the person in stirrups, then that's something different. And that is something different here. If the person is saying yes, for whatever reason, you know, can I put this in there? Yes, go ahead, do it. At that moment in time when the entry occurs, is it something that the person wants, is agreeing to, consents to, or is it something that they don't want, they're not agreeing to, they're being forced to undergo? That's the difference. Rape is not getting someone to want the entry to occur. Rape is entering someone who doesn't want it to occur. In South Dakota, we have no criminalization of fraud when it comes to the point of obtaining a person's consent.
That's a different point, but I guess just to follow up one more time, because I don't think we're having a meeting of the minds here, and I'm trying to understand your position. The doctor has sexual penetration with a patient who consented to a procedure, a medical procedure. That patient hasn't consented to, you agree, has not consented to sexual penetration. They've only consented to a medical procedure.
I'm saying that they have consented to the penetration. And when the penetration is consented to, there's no distinguishing in the law whether or not that is rape or not. If they've consented, they've consented.
The law has a definite definition of sexual penetration.
It does, and that's the entry. That's the entry.
Did you make this argument to the trial court?
Yes, I did.
What was the trial court's ruling?
The court ruled, well, the court just didn't give the proposed theory of defense instructions. We had one instruction that was given for the purpose of establishing that consent can constitute a defense, but the other theory of the defense instructions were not given. As it relates to the judgment of acquittal portion, the trial court simply ruled that the motion for judgment of acquittal was denied. And mind you, throughout the transcripts, we have numerous quotes where A.M. agreed, allowed, wanted, consented, and even said it was of her own free will, that Ted Clout did nothing to deprive her of her own free will. So the court denied the objection.
The woman who goes to the doctor and says, I went in for a pelvic exam, is going to say exactly the same thing. Yes, I consented to a pelvic exam, but I didn't consent to him having sexual penetration. I mean, isn't that her right to make that distinction? Or does simply by agreeing to have someone enter you for a medical reason or a bogus medical reason the same thing as agreeing to having sex?
Well, there are cases have held that it is the same thing as agreeing to having sex. There are cases in other jurisdictions where that is said. But the point is this. If we base this all subjectively on what individuals are thinking in these various events, then we're not stepping back and looking at the law. And what does our law in South Dakota criminalize? It criminalizes entry through force, coercion, or threats of immediate bodily injury, etc. It does not criminalize entry by deception. We have numerous quotes in the...
Why doesn't coercion, the very definition of coercion, involve deception? Why can't you... Why when you look at coercion, you want to equate it to force, is my understanding.
Correct.
That's your argument.
Correct.
Why couldn't it involve deception?
Well, I think that coercion can involve deception if that coercion results to threat or force to another person, or threat towards the individual that is not true. But when we go back and look at the way the rape law developed from Havens on, what used to have to be proven was lack of consent. What used to have to be proven was a physical resistance more than token. And that's what constituted a rape, was this entry by force, this violent entry by force. And that evolved up after 1975 with the change in the statute into this compulsion. And then we get this coercion language. So just simply saying that, well, I felt pressured, so I agreed, that's not enough. Coercion implies something more. It implies force. It implies overbearing a person's will. It implies making them do something that they don't want to do. It doesn't mean getting them to want to do what it is that the person wants them to do.
Why don't you just bring the water up with you?
It doesn't fit under here.
Oh, okay. Well, leave it on top of the podium.
Doesn't the coercion instruction include the word pressure?
It does include the word pressure. It does include the word pressure. Pressure, threats, or intimidation. And it also says that coercion exists where one is, by the unlawful conduct of another, induced to perform some act under circumstances which deprive her of the exercise of her free will. Here, A.M. agreed that she exercised her free will.
Let me ask you about the unlawful conduct aspect of the coercion instruction. Where did that come from? And what did you argue, or what were the arguments about unlawful conduct constituting coercion?
Well, it was our worry that based upon this statement, unlawful conduct and the coercion instruction, that a jury could feel that deceiving somebody into consenting to a penetration could be unlawful, while there was no other instruction saying that. And we'd ask for a theory of defense instruction that would clear that up and would set forth that deception is not unlawful when used to obtain the consent of another, because there's no statutory prohibition.
Well, what about deceit? Statutory deceit. That's wrongful or unlawful conduct. Why could that... civil deceit would be wrongful conduct. It's a tort. Why could that not constitute coercion under the court's instruction that required unlawful conduct?
Well, because he's facing the criminal charge of rape, which has a statute that specifies what the meaning is, and to pull some civil standard in of what would constitute deceit as unlawful conduct.
But the statute doesn't use the word unlawful conduct in defining coercion.
Correct.
Coercion is not defined in the statute. So the court defined it by saying it's unlawful conduct, and deceit is unlawful conduct.
I disagree that deceit is unlawful conduct. Unlawful conduct implies criminal conduct, and he's facing a criminal charge. To convict him of a criminal charge based upon a civil standard or a civil definition for which one cannot receive punishment would defeat the purpose of a criminal trial. Then we would be in a situation where you'd be pulling in all these civil statutes and listing them as instructions that the jury was to follow.
I assume you objected to this definition of coercion in Instruction 7.
I didn't object to the definition of coercion. I was fine with the definition of coercion. The definition of coercion had force and coercion as synonymous. I did want to be able to, with my theory of defense instruction, show what in our view was lawful conduct, i.e. contact between a foster parent and a foster child so long as other legal standards are met, and showing that there is no legal prohibition against deceiving another to obtain consent, which is exactly which is exactly the point. We were deprived of that instruction. The state was able to argue that this constituted second-degree rape. If you find, you know, if coercion is here and if you find it, then the concept of consent doesn't apply. I did not get the countervailing instructions to say the opposite, that, wait a second, this deception isn't unlawful. Wait a second, this foster parent stuff isn't unlawful in and of itself. That doesn't mean that it constitutes coercion. I didn't get the instruction that said, when consent is an issue, the state would have to prove lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt. They get to stand up and hold the instruction 10 that says if it's coercion, consent doesn't even apply. I don't get to stand up and say to the jury with an instruction pointing to the instruction and saying, wait a second, they've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there is a lack of consent here. How can they prove that? She said I've consented. She said I've agreed. She said I wanted this to occur. She said I wanted to make money on this thing. You cannot withdraw the consent after the act and say, well, you know, I consented, I made a mistake, I had all the wrong information, and because of that, let's look backwards in time and turn it into a rape. That's why I start off by saying there's no such thing as rape by trick in South Dakota. Coercion. Coercion, yes, coercion has the definition listed in instruction number 7, and that requires something more than just a little bit of pressure. It requires force. It requires overbearing a person's free will. And how can they say that consent did not occur here when AM says that, in fact, it did? How can they say that?
Let me ask you a little bit about that. You know, because you say she made this decision of her own free will, and certainly she repeatedly said that I consented to this procedure. But, you know, looking at the record and looking at the background, we have a girl at 15 who's been abused by her father, comes to your client's home, and he gains her trust and, in a sense, grooms her for what he's about to do, because he's telling her that she has to pose in the nude in order to have her clothes fit properly. He's having her pose with his... and he's taking pictures of her, in explicit poses when she's, 15 or 16 years old. Is there some question that came to the jury about... You know, how much of this child's free will had been broken down, how much of her sense of her own bodily autonomy had been taken away. I mean, after all, Mr. Clout was her father figure, in a sense, in her life, and so he's grooming her to a point where he now says she did this of her free will. That's a long question, but I guess my question is, you know, at what point do we draw a line between a true consent and something where her sense of herself has been taken away?
Well, the idea that her sense of herself has been taken away, I don't think that that's borne out by the evidence. You know, she testified that he wanted her to cuddle with him and sit on his lap, and she would say no. She testified that all of these procedures were essentially the same, with the exception of one, where she said, "You act like you're liking this," and then he pulled away, stopped, walked away, and she says, "No, come back in and get this done." This is a young woman who, when he was describing what was occurring, she was saying, just shut up and do it, get it done. This was a street smart girl. She'd been through a lot. It's true, it's unfortunate, it should not happen that way, but this was not someone who, in like State versus Willis, was mentally retarded. This is someone who was above the legal age of consent. This was someone who said, yes, even as late as the fall of 2006, 6-8 months after the last charged event in this county, was saying, I was still interested in doing it, I still wanted to do it. This isn't somebody who had injuries from this indicating that there was force. The only injury that was ever talked about was a slight pinch when the speculum opened up. This is not the kind of a rape case that is a forcible rape case. This is a bad situation, but the law is being pulled over these facts, stretched over these facts, in a way to try to pull this factual situation in when it's not supported by the statutes. Simply, there is no prohibition against deceiving someone to obtain penetration. If there were, it would take up many other types of cases. Is this bad? Yes. Is it terrible? Yes. Should it have not happened? It never, ever should have happened. But this is not force. How can you say, if a jury is instructed that if there's consent, they can't convict, how can you say that a conviction is valid when the person who is claiming the rape says, I in fact consented. If that exists,
The two are mutually exclusive. You cannot cut that pole in half. You cannot pull away that weld. If there is consent, there is no rape, which is why we get to the theory of defense instructions. That gravamen is the heart of a rape case is lack of consent, and the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no consent. They get to say, consent doesn't apply. I don't get to stand up and say, now, wait a second, that consent, you've got to be sure beyond a reasonable doubt here that there was no consent before you can convict. I could not hold that instruction up. I'd ask that the convictions be reversed for the reasons set forth in my brief.
I have one question, as long as you have a few minutes or a minute left here. One of your principal arguments is on the jury instruction that requested to tell the jury that certain conduct was not prohibited by the law.
Correct.
Specifically, the relationship between the foster parent and the foster child.
Correct.
You're a very experienced trial lawyer. Do you know of any other situation where we instruct juries what is not unlawful conduct? I find this unprecedented that you're asking us to impose a requirement as to what is not unlawful conduct.
Well, no, I don't know of another case where that has occurred. But the reason that it's necessary is because it's a correct statement of the law and it's supported by the facts, and it allows me to say, hey, this is not against the law, so you can't use that as the unlawful conduct that you plug into the coercion and then hammer him as a result.
Your time has expired, Mr. Wrench. Thank you very much. Ms. DeMatte, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please court and counsel. I hope the court will indulge me just a few minutes to talk about some extremely critical facts that I think the defendant has glossed over in this case. He's trying to paint this as a situation where this was nothing other than deceit or trickery, and that is absolutely not the case. I'd like to start out by telling you how the trial judge assessed this case at sentencing, and this is in the sentencing transcript. When he said the most aggravating factor of all was your blatant abuse of power that you used as a foster parent and as a legislator, and I believe you used that power to achieve the gains that you wanted. His gains, not these victims. This was never their will. This was not a case of mere deception or trickery. The evidence was sufficient to establish both force and coercion on each count that was charged, that he's challenging here on the sufficiency of the evidence case. I think it's absolutely critical that you understand how AM was describing what was going on during these events. She testifies that in each of these counts, she was crying, she was biting her arm, she's covering her face with her hand, she's closing her legs, and the defendant has to keep prying them back open to finish these procedures. Does that sound like consent or the exercise of somebody's free will?
Well, she did say, though, repeatedly that she consented.
No, I disagree with that. What you see in defendant's brief are him picking out isolated answers to some of his leading questions and then leaving out the context and the bigger picture of what was going on here. I'll give you an example of some of that. She lists these long recitation of some of the times where she said she agreed to certain things. Well, and first off, every time she answered a question that said she agreed or yes, I consented, it was, I agreed to the procedure. I agreed to the exam. I agreed to the egg donation. There was no exam. There was no procedure. There was no egg donation. What was going on here was him penetrating her for his own sexual gratification, pure and simple.
Well, but just let me get the facts straight here, though. She did say she consented to this procedure, bogus or not.
Well,
is that right, or am I getting the facts wrong?
You know, here, if I could refer to a few things in the transcript when he's asking her this. The defendant talks about, he put in a quote, you allowed him to do it, didn't you? Yes. Well, the very next question, you never told him that he could not do it, did you? Well, just by, like, all my actions, like crying and biting my arm and basically stating I was so uncomfortable with him doing it. Well, you never told him that he could not do it, did you? I told him that I didn't want him to do it. Another portion here where the defendant puts in, now, he would stop the examinations. You would say, come back and do these. Let's get these over with, wouldn't you? because he was being mean and disrespectful, and if I didn't let him finish, he would be mean. Other portions, I didn't want him to be mad at me and treat me like crap. So she asked him to finish the exam. He asked her, and this wasn't quoted in the defendant's brief, "You weren't afraid of Mr. Clout?" "I was, yes." Other things that she said regarding the closing of the legs, "It was because I was so uncomfortable and my body just kept wanting them, like forcing them closed because I was so uncomfortable." How do you distinguish those actions from what happened with J.S.? He's not challenging the sufficiency of the evidence on the rape count pertaining to J.S., and my understanding is because she verbally said no while he's penetrating her with this dildo or vibrator. What is the difference between verbally saying no and these actions of crying, biting your arm, covering your eyes, closing your legs? What reasonable person in the defendant's situation could possibly consider that to be consent or the exercise of the free will? And I think it's very important to point out, I think Justice Mary Henry, you asked the question, whether he objected to that definition of coercion. The defense didn't. He is not up here claiming that any instruction given by the trial court was incorrect as a matter of law. And the fact of the matter is, he was able to get up and make every single argument that he's made in his brief and that he's making here today to the jury, and the jury saw right through that. And they didn't believe this was consent.
Your theory of the case all comes down to coercion, correct?
I think there's both force and coercion. Now, whether or not force and coercion are synonymous or what word you attach to it, but when you're looking at things like crying, closing her legs, biting her arm that's going on during this offense, I think you could argue that's a straight-up force case. But
you could argue it, but it's not force is not the traditional. It's not the traditional definition of force.
He used,
in most cases.
Well, there was no physical threat of force.
All right, let's go to coercion because that's my question. Under the court's instructions, which guided the jury in deciding this case, the court told the jury that coercion, the type of coercion involved, had to be unlawful conduct. What did Mr. Clout do in obtaining consent? I'm not saying the procedure, but in obtaining the consent.
Well,
what did he do? What part of his conduct was unlawful?
Look, I think we need to look at all of the circumstances of what was going on here. First of all, we've got him. He's her foster parent. AM came into that home when she was, I believe, 14 or 15 years old. Not only was she a foster parent, or was he a foster parent, she was a ward of the Department of Corrections. Okay, so she's got the threat, and he used the threat of lockup hanging over her from the outset when she moves into that house. Then he takes nude photographs of her at age 15, tells her to shave her private parts, and she asks why. He says, "Just do it." That's in the transcript. He uses manipulation and control. She has to report her periods on a monthly basis to him. I mean, talk about what kind of manipulation and control is going on here. Then we have this email pressure, this barrage that starts. I don't know if you've had a chance to read any of those, but there are things going on in there that I think are also critical that explain how what her state and his state was when these were going on. They tell her, try to relax so the test won't hurt so much. He uses money. He gives her a $250 payment purporting to be from the egg donation company and says, she gets emails saying, "Well, gee, not to be overbearing, but we did send you this money and we expect you to complete this.
Hurry up and
get these done."
Let me stop you right there because all of those things are utterly disgusting and clearly civilly unlawful. But what was criminally unlawful about any of those things that you've just listed?
Well, when you look at that instruction came from State versus Willis. And I think it's verbatim the instruction that was given in State versus Willis and approved by this court. I'm not so sure that the word unlawful in that statement requires some additional unlawful conduct in addition to the force and coercion that's being employed to cause somebody to have sexual penetration. You know, I think that's kind of a circular statement the way that's written. But If you think that it does, I mean, it doesn't make sense that they have to have some other unlawful conduct occurring at the same time that they're using force and coercion to cause somebody or to sexually penetrate somebody, because that in itself is unlawful. I don't think it requires some additional unlawful conduct on top of that. But if you think it does...
Why didn't you object to the instruction then?
It was given because it was the instruction approved out of State versus Willis.
Right, but it was never an issue. It was never part of the holding or anything. It was just referred to in State versus Willis.
And, correct.
And, you know, they just kind of recited what the instruction was, and they never, and that was not the issue, was it?
No, well, you know, I don't think this particular argument was ever raised before the trial court. I don't recall anyone having this discussion on whether or not there was additional unlawful conduct. When Mr. Wrench proposed his instruction number 9, you know, I believe his argument, he wanted to be able to argue that there was nothing unlawful about these two things that he picks out, which just happened to be some of the facts and circumstances
so come back
in this
to my
case.
Question. Why didn't the state object to that insertion of the unlawful conduct in there?
We proposed that instruction. Your
and
Honor.
And there was no objection to it. The
no.
state objected to other parts of the instruction, but they never had any objection to that.
No. I don't see it as an objectionable instruction. I think it is a correct instruction. It was approved by this court in Willis.
Yep. Well, that was my point. It really wasn't approved. It was just recited. In State versus Willis, it was not approved.
Actually, I believe it was, Your Honor. My understanding is that was an issue in the case, is whether or not the court gave a proper definition of the term coercion, and that's the instruction that was given, and this court held that it was.
Okay. I disagree, but that's what it's all about, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was my understanding of what the Willis court did. But, you know, in any event, the concept of coercion that was approved there is certainly broad enough to cover the facts of this case because...
So, you know, along that line, following up, though, that particular instruction that you proposed equates force and coercion. It does not include psychological manipulation. It doesn't include deceit. Aren't you then bound to show that there was some force and the argument is there was no force?
Well, I would disagree. I think there was plenty of evidence of force. But what the instruction said was one induced to do an act under circumstances which deprive her of the exercise of her free will. It can be actual physical force or implied. Now, the relationship is one where one is under subjection to the other. I think that certainly implies psychological measures. It doesn't require physical force or some kind of physical restraint to be put on the person. That is broad enough to encompass the psychological, the moral, intellectual, what have you.
But I think don't we interpret criminal statutes narrowly as opposed to some broad sweep because somebody's got to know whether it's criminal or not.
I agree that the defendant should be able to know that his conduct is wrongful or criminal, and there was no doubt that he knew it was criminal in this case. There was evidence
that's
in the
subjective. Don't we have to look at it in an objective sense and how it would then apply to other situations?
I think the concept of coercion here is not a concept that is difficult for someone in the facts of this case to realize that they are committing unlawful conduct. I don't think there's anybody that hears the facts of these cases that has a real question that the legislature would intend this conduct to be considered rape and coercion under our rape statute. This court cited the case of State versus McNair, which is a Nevada case, with the doctor scenario very much, Justice Konenkamp, like you were referring to, recognizing that submission does not equal consent. At best, what you have here is submission, not consent, not the exercise of your free will. How can you exercise the free will when you have all of these pressures coming down on you, when you have the deceit, when you have this abuse of trust in this inherent coercive relationship that occurred here in the foster parent scenario? You know, that I would argue that this is even more, the one being under subjection to another is even more prevalent and inherent in this case than it was in Willis. In Willis, you've got a residential instructor with minimal contact, or not as great a contact with the victim there as in this case. He controlled every aspect of this girl's life. You can't overlook that fact.
I want to ask a little bit about the deceit, though, and counsel, defense counsel's argument. Many states do have a law prohibiting obtaining sex by deceit. South Dakota does not. Is that right?
I wouldn't know if I'd say many states. I think there are a few states out there that specifically have deceit or fraud in their statute. And I think that those were, my understanding is that in those scenarios, they passed those statutes because of overly narrow interpretations of statutes by courts addressing really appalling facts like facts in this case.
Do you think that South Dakota has a gap in not having a protection for people who were deceived into having sex?
I don't, when you consider how coercion was defined in the instruction in this case and as in the case of State v. Willis, because I think it's broad enough to encompass that. Now, you know, it all comes down to, does it deprive you of the exercise of your free will? And there are several means that I think you can use to arrive at that end. And so that's what we're looking at here.
I've got to stop you right there, because it doesn't come down to only whether you were deprived of your exercise of free will. It comes down to whether you were coerced into that. And so it really comes down to a question of coercion rather than the deprivation of free will. Everyone agrees probably that the free will was deprived in this case. The question is, how was that free will deprived?
I think you're correct. And it's not... It has to be the defendant's actions of coercion and force which cause you to be deprived of your free will. I agree with that. And I think the facts that I've talked about in this case point out that it was his actions. He was using a number of different means which amount to coercion and force to deprive her of her free will. And, you know, as you point that out, I'd like to, before I run out of time, discuss one of the other jury instructions, because I think your point ties in with that. In this argument that the defendant made, well, that they should have been instructed that the state had to prove lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, it's a circular argument, okay? This court has held in more than one occasion that in order for consent to be a defense, it has to utterly negate force and coercion. Okay, so once the state is obligated to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the acts were committed by force and coercion, then by necessity you have negated the affirmative defense of consent. So there can be no prejudice to having a second instruction which says essentially the same thing in the reverse. And so, and that was, I think, the primary argument with regard to his instruction number 8, I believe, because otherwise he got the essential core of what he needed to argue his consent defense, which was, if you find there has been consent, then you must acquit. And that was made clear to the jury, and the defendant got up and made every single one of these same arguments that he's making to the court today to the jury, and the jury rejected it. And I think you can tell, as by the way the trial court summed up the case in sentencing, that the trial court rejected it as well, and I think this court needs to respect that finding. Now, with regard to the issue of the other requested instruction on the deceit and the foster parent relationship. This court, you know, I don't think the South Dakota court has necessarily been presented with a case where nothing other than deception was at play here. And as I said, this is not that case. There are so many other factors at play here that you don't necessarily need to reach that decision, because we have this inherent coercive relationship of the foster parent. She's a ward of the state. You know, all of these other factors are at play. I think the way you put it earlier, her bodily autonomy was violated from the get-go when she was at this man's house. So there are plenty of other things to point to. But this court defendant essentially cited one case on that issue, and this was the Silveris case out of Massachusetts, I believe it was, which also cited a prior Massachusetts case. But you have to look at the exact statute at play in each of these cases. There are all kinds of cases out here on these issues. And you can't neatly lump them into categories and say the majority holds this and the minority holds this, because every state's rape statute and sexual assault statutes are written just a little bit differently. And every fact pattern that comes up is a little bit different. these Massachusetts cases that he cited required force and against somebody's consent. And the court hung its hat on the force element in that case and said they're independent factors, so you have to find something in addition to force. That is different from South Dakota's statute. On the other hand, our court has cited State versus McNair in the Jones case, and McNair was the Nevada doctor case with this scenario of a woman consenting to a pelvic examination, and then something entirely different than what she consented to happens during that pelvic examination, and that court found that submission under those circumstances does not equal consent. And what is key is, in that case and in several others by other courts, they were dealing with statutes that did not specifically have deceit or fraud in their statutory construction either. They had words like compulsion or force or, you know, similar type terms that all get to the same concept of against somebody's free will. And none of them, I think there are very few that I've seen that have coercion, like South Dakota's does in our statute, which encompasses, I think, this broader aspect and array of conduct that includes psychological pressures, moral pressures, intellectual pressures, whatever the case may be, in order to look at ultimately did something the defendant did coerce and force this person to engage in an act against their will.
Hasn't the legislature kind of gone the other way on that? They have made it criminal conduct to have theft by deception, not just theft by fraud or theft by force or theft by coercion. They've prohibited theft by deception, but they've never prohibited penetration by deception or rape by deception. So aren't you going against what the legislature has actually prohibited as illegal conduct?
I don't believe so, and I don't believe that there is the word coercion in any of our theft statutes either. So it goes back to what does this concept of coercion encompass? And if it encompasses one means of arriving there as deception, then I think that is sufficient. And as I said, this is not a case where deception was the only means that arrived, caused this person to act against their will.
Now, the trial court gave an instruction that force and coercion are synonymous. Did you agree with that?
We objected to that particular line of that instruction, but as the court defined force, I think the court defined force in a manner that also encompassed pressure, I think something other than simply physical force. I think your gut reaction when you hear the term force is to think of something physical, and so we thought it was, when it was offered by the court, maybe misleading if that's the interpretation of force that you're using. But then when you read the rest of the instruction as to how force was actually defined, then I think it's a correct statement of the law.
Thank you, Ms. DeMann.
Thank you.
Mr. Wrench, you have 10 minutes, sir.
If I were up here on a simple assault case where I was claiming self-defense and the court had not instructed that it was the state's burden to prove that it was not self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, it would be automatically reversed. When there's an affirmative defense, as the state has taken the position that this consent is, the state has the burden to come in and disprove the existence of that affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, Ms. DeMani said as a general observation that you got to argue everything to the jury that you're arguing to us today.
I did, and let me tell you why that requires a retrial. Because everything that I argue to the jury that I'm arguing today, if my theory of defense instructions had been given, I could have said to the jury, look, my argument is embodied in this theory of defense instruction. My argument is the law that you were to follow in this case. An argument by a lawyer in a jury, in front of a jury on a case like this, where I'm telling you what, when you walk in and try a case like this, everybody acts like it's going to be so fair and it's going to be so straight up and it's going to be so perfect, but I'm telling you, you're way behind the eight ball when you start. If I'm trying to make an argument without backing it up by the jury instructions, it is simply unpersuasive vapor. The only way that I can make a convincing argument in a case like this is to hold up the instructions and say to the jury, I know you want to hammer this guy. I know you don't like what he did. I know you don't want to let him get away with this, but this is the law you were sworn to follow. The heart of a rape case is lack of consent. If there exists consent, there cannot be rape. The state has the burden of proving that there was no consent beyond a reasonable doubt. If they can't do that, you must acquit. That's what it said in my instruction. There was never one instruction that said to this jury that consent had to be disproved beyond a reasonable doubt. And if I could have an instruction that said that, I read the line that says, the state has the burden to prove lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt, and folks, guess what? You heard it from her own mouth that she consented. I asked her 9 ways to Sunday if she consented, and she said she consented, and because of that, it is your duty to acquit. That is a much more powerful argument if I'm holding a jury instruction that the jury is sworn to follow, that the jury is obligated under their oath to look at, than just listening to me when I am on the other side of a courtroom on a case like this, where when I stand up, I'm dead in the water at the outset. I have to have instructions to be able to fairly argue a case like this.
And what's your response then to the Fainrich case, which says consent is not an element of second-degree rape to be disproven by the state? It is a defense to be raised which may negate the element of force, coercion, or threat.
My response is we raised the defense. The defense was raised the moment that I said to A.M., did you consent? And she said yes. The defense is raised at that point in time. Once that is an issue, it's supported by the facts and thus requires an instruction. If the instruction is a correct statement of the law, that once it's an issue, the state has to disprove it, then the defendant is entitled to it as a matter of constitutional principle. What then would be the response that Jones, after Fainrich, years after Fainrich, Jones, this court passed on an instruction that where the jury was instructed that the state had to prove lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt? Why would that be if that were not the case? It would have to be. It would have to be. That's why we get back to the heart of a rape case being lack of consent. Because if there's consent, there can be no rape, and if there's no consent, there's rape. That's why their argument is, in fact, circular, because they try to forestall me from arguing consent by saying, look at instruction number 10, coercion is there, consent doesn't apply, just don't worry a bit about it. I can then look at 10A, I can say to the jury, hey, if there's consent here, you must acquit. But I'm deprived of the lines that are following thereafter that should have been given in this instruction about the state having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt lack of consent. The same as it would be in any other affirmative defense type case. The same as it would be in an insanity case. The same way it would be in a simple assault case when self-defense was raised in the course of the evidence. The question becomes, is it supported by the facts, that is the instruction, and is it a correct statement of the law? If so, the defendant is entitled to it. The tripod of this defense was chopped apart and we were left with one peg leg and we were laying down on the floor. If those three defense theory of defense instructions had been given, the result of this trial would have been different. The jury would have had no choice because of the way the testimony came in. There was a statement made about these, about how terrible this whole situation was and that A.M. was crying and things like that when she was closing her legs. This was important at the trial because, of course, if you have someone that's closing their legs and another person trying to force their way in, you worry that that becomes rape because that's how it is stopped. You close the legs. But when I went through the testimony with AM at 485 and 487 of the record, I asked her this question. It's not like you decided that you didn't want these procedures to occur and therefore you were closing your legs, right? Answer. I was still under the impression that this was real, so in a sense I wanted them done because I was so uncomfortable, but then I wanted him to finish so I can get on with the donor program. Question. If you were still under the impression that all of this was real, then you wanted him to be able to make whatever examinations inside there that were occurring so that you could be through with it, and that's why you allowed it to happen. Isn't that right? Yes. Question. So it's not like if you wanted the egg donation process to occur, it's not like you were closing your legs and forcing him to stop because you didn't want that to happen. Is that fair? Answer, yes. Statement was made to you just a moment ago by the attorney for the state that she was under threat of going to DOC. Page 475 of the trial transcript. Question, the only time that you claim that anything like this was said when you first arrived was when you first arrived at the residence in 2003, that since you were from DOC, if you didn't follow the rules, you could get in trouble. Is that true? Answer, yes. question. So it's not like you submitted to these procedures because he said, if you don't, I'm going to lie about you and have you put in prison. Is it right? Answer, yes. She was not submitting. She was choosing to participate in the hope of making money. The money was not there. It was a wrong, terrible thing to do. It should never have happened. But it is not right. And if we change the statutes in midstream, there's no way you can ever try a case because then you won't have a fair joining of the issues. In this case, it is our position that Ted Clout did not have a fair joining of the issues. It was bad enough going in on these facts. The state got to have jury instruction 10 and say consent did not apply with coercion. We didn't get to have the logical progression of our instructions so that I could make the arguments to the jury. Back to your question. Did I make every argument? I did. But ask yourselves this, all of you who've been involved in the trial, been on the trial bench. Is an argument stronger if it's simply made by a lawyer, let alone a defense lawyer? Or is it stronger if you get to hold the jury instruction up there and say, you know, folks, I know you probably want to get at this guy, but you're obligated on your oath to follow these instructions, and this instruction says this, and thus my argument is this. It strengthens the argument. We did not have a fair joining of the issues in pretrial.
Did the state take what you view to be unfair advantage in closing the argument that you did not have these instructions?
Well, I believe that the state did, and here's how. The state says, well, you know, consent, coercion is that, and consent wouldn't apply, and even if there is consent, they were consenting to something other than what happened, and therefore there's no consent at all. The state argued the facts of the case based upon the existence of the instructions that they had and based upon the facts in the record, and I couldn't get up and point to instructions to counterbalance that.
2 minutes.
Very good. Thank you. Moving to the situation involving the judgment of acquittals. Maybe the legislature will change the law to allow deception as the basis for rape. But it does not exist now. There is no such thing as rape by trick. How can you say that is rape when the alleged victim says, I wanted it to happen, I agreed to it, I allowed it, I have permitted it, I consented to it, and I ask her, did he do anything to deprive you of your own free will? Well, I don't know what free will is. It's your choice to make a choice here. No, he didn't. He didn't. In this case, if it were any other type of situation, it would be an easy one. What complicates it is this foster daughter situation. You still have girls who were, A.M. was 17 when they began, 18 when they ended. J.S. was 19 when it occurred. And you're not dealing with mentally challenged people. You're not dealing with mentally retarded people as they were in State versus Willis. And while this was a dupe, this was a trick, it was a bad thing to do, it was not forcible rape. It was not a violation of that statute. Those three counts should be reversed for insufficient evidence. And if they're not reversed, at the very least, we should have a retrial where we have our instructions and we can have a fair fight instead of walking into a machine gun. I walked into a machine gun without the instructions, and there was no way to properly advocate the case in a way that would allow a jury to acquit. I'd ask that this be reversed, and if I've missed anything, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wrench. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.